Please help me offer a warm welcome for Tyndall S. of Los Angeles.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm Tyndall. I'm an alcoholic. This is an awesome place. This is just a picture of health for me. Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you, Jerry. It was hard getting here. And the reason why I say that is because I'm the reluctant alcoholic. I'm the alcoholic that feels like I've done so dang much. I'm the alcoholic that feels like my job is burdening me and woe is me, I want to rest on the weekend. And I'm the alcoholic who cries, who kicks, who screams, and who shows up anyway. You know, and that's the story of my life. I have 18 arrests for prostitution, drinking and using, and I love to fight the police. I love to be 95 pounds and drunk on a hot day where I've had no food and I've been chasing little white rocks up and down the street and drinking and fighting whoever picks up my alcohol, sitting on the curb, laughing at people going back and forth to work. And then crying when nighttime comes, cursing the world, cursing myself. Big Book says, cursing myself for being a weakling. I'm the girl that when the police come to rescue me, I plant my feet and I say, I think I can take them. Violently, disgustingly antisocial is what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me. I'm the girl that loves to fight. I'm the girl that, if I'm not fighting, something's wrong. I must not be drunk. You know, and for me, it was a hopeless and endless cycle of trying to figure out what's wrong with me. Why can't I stop? Why can't I get it together? I had so many hopes and so many dreams. I had so many scholarships. One of the brightest girls in my school. My mother had hopes and dreams for me, and I needed her approval so badly. So whatever it took, a good grade, I'm fine, there's nothing wrong, dress this way, look this way, say what you need to hear, go to charm school, I did it. But boy, that alcohol set me free. I got a few cuss words I could say about what alcohol did for me. And I mean, I had a love affair with not being charming and not being smart and not being cute and not being dressed well and smelling like I don't know what. I tramped the streets of Inglewood, California for about 9 years. If you told me I was homeless, I would not believe you because I went from pillar to post. If I found a man that let me in, that's where I went. I had a beautiful daughter I had at age 17, and I was ashamed and embarrassed that none of that stuff worked. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was through H&I. My 18th arrest, Sybil Brand had a panel, and they came in, and they sat down, and they said they had been where I'd been, and they had done what I'd done, and they found a way out. And I'm here to let you know, if you're new, we found a way out. Your story is sufficient. You don't have to add anything to it. You can keep your sobriety date. All I had to do was be willing to go to any length to stay sober. 24 hours. The world record. 24 hours. I had no idea how to do 24 hours. I had no idea how to be willing to stay sober. But I knew what it was like to be willing to go to any length for a drink. They said a lot of the principles in the street are the same ones that you can get on the other side. I want to share this too. What I learned since I've been here, I truly believe why the newcomer is so important. It's because there is this joy from just coming down and just getting free that we need to see so we can keep hope. The hope that I'm going to get another drink, or the hope that I'm going to get another fix, or the hope that I'm going to meet somebody and they're going to give me the kindness of a stranger when out on the street. That same hope comes in here with them. And I need to keep it. And it's so important to work with the newcomer. It's so important to be able to tell the message. It's so important to go to a book study. It's so important to give my number out. It's so important to call newcomers even if they don't call me. It's so important to realize I need the program more than you do. But I suffer. I'm prey to misery and depression. I suffer with getting older. I suffer with having been badly mangled by alcohol. I do whatever I can. Right now, my life is beyond my wildest dreams. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous run through my blood. But the thing about them running through your blood is that they're running through your blood. And things I want to do, like lie, get to work late, not pay taxes, not care about my animals all the time, you know, not go to a meeting. I can't not do it. I have to go. I have to be there. I have to show up. And as a matter of fact, when I'm grateful, I'm glad to show up. Tonight, I'm really, 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 really grateful. This is a picture of health for me. You know, my life, we're in the first step right now in the book study that I'm going to, Never Too Early Big Book Study in Gardena. And it's a wonderful opportunity for me to grow more. And what I've learned is that as I be willing to go through the steps again, I see new stuff. You know, yesterday I shared a fourth step with someone, and actually when I walked in today, you were sharing page 65. And I said, I'm right where I'm supposed to be. And I was thanking Jerry. I was thanking him for getting me here. You know, I would have missed out on all you beautiful people. The message that I have is that those arrests, those 18 arrests that I had, because of the 12-step of Alcoholics Anonymous, a hunger was fed in me to go to school. A hunger was fed in me to work with people in the community. A hunger was fed in me to think about the people that go to jail and don't have a way out, don't know what to do. And I have a pretty sharp tongue, and in some environments it works really, really well. What I thought was a defect actually works really, really well, because I go into lockup every day for people who are looking at 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 10 years, 16, 20, 25 years, you know, life sentences. And I get to work in the same courthouse where I got all my arrests at. 360 because of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. 360 because of being willing to go back to Inglewood Police Station and make amends. Because of seeing that the police were rescuing me. They were not messing with my high. They were not taking my alcohol from me, as I used to think. They were saving my life. You know, I don't know where my life will take me, but I'm really glad it's going to take me sober one day at a time. I like to ask you, please join us. Join us on this journey. Join us on this journey of self-discovery. I want to thank the ladies that sat at the table with me, too, because we were going through the four steps together, and I really enjoyed that. You know, and I was telling them, say this prayer, God, please help me see the truth. Help me see the truth about my condition. Help me know that I am the real one. I'm the one that cannot drink in any form or fashion at all. That once I take one, I cannot break the habit. I lose all things. You know, I have been, I was telling Jerry too, we were singing, I was saying, I've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb, because I'm sold out, you know. This isn't a religious program, but guess what? Only God came and got me. I thank God for this program. Thank you for letting me share.
Harry from Los Angeles.
Good evening, family. I'm Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic. And first and foremost, I want to thank God for my life tonight, y'all, in the program Alcoholics Anonymous, for helping me find a God of my understanding. And for that, I'm truly grateful. I want to thank Mr. Hassman and Suzanne for their hospitality. Thank Kendall for rolling with me. And, you know, I'm just grateful. I'm grateful. I want to thank all y'all for being here. I want to thank those who came before me. You guys kept the door open. You know what I mean? Because you knew a guy like me was coming. And I had nowhere else to go. I had nowhere else to go. You know, and you guys would say stuff to me like, this is the only place you can go where the worse off you are when you get here, the better your chances of staying. You know, I ain't, you know, okay, because I ain't been invited nowhere in a while, so I'm grateful. You know what I'm saying? Okay, you know, so, you know, I thank God for that. You know, 6,490 days today. You know what I'm saying? Thank you. Thank you. And I ain't got no mystical calendar at the house checking them off either. I got the app, you know what I mean? So, you know, I'll let you know I got the app, right? I got sober December the 2nd of 1999. And I don't say that to impress nobody but myself. Because if you be anything like me, you know, I thought I was going to die out there drinking and using. I just did, because I didn't think it was a way out, because I tried everything I possibly could to just put it down. You know, I had these children that was dependent on me. I knew what my job was, but I just couldn't pull it off. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was born and raised in Hartford, Connecticut, and I was taught better. I was taught as a man you're supposed to take care of yours. And that includes them seeds. You do what you have to do to take care of them seeds. You keep a roof over their head, you clothe them, and you feed them. And you love them. That's what you do as a man. And I couldn't pull that off, and I didn't know what was wrong with me, y'all. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know that lack of power was my dilemma when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, see, I've been Holy Ghost filled and water baptized, and I was speaking tongue. I would lay hands on the sick and would think they would recover, but something crazy happened when I got a paycheck. I became a new man on Sunday, and me and him was in the Momo peeking out the curtains. Striking a pose. You know, I want to say welcome to the young lady with 5 days, too. And I don't mean to bust your bubble, but I ain't look nothing like that with 5 days when I got here. I'm going to tell you right now. I don't even know. I mean, you know, the tale of the tape for me, man, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, man, is I had burnt my life completely down to the ground. Wasn't nothing left. Wasn't nothing left but hope. Burnt to the ground. And I remember owing the IRS, owing EDD, owing the State Department, owing Pookie, owing Dulo. I mean, I remember owing everybody. You know what I'm saying? I had to drink off all the kids, you know what I mean? Because I thought that's how I wanted to be. You know what I mean? I had alienated everybody from my family. You know, when all the smoke cleared, you know what I'm saying? It would be 11 years before I lay eyes on my own mother. It would be 16 years before I pick up my son again, who I dropped off at 12 years old. Before I ever lay eyes on him again, be 16. You know, and I drank off the other two kids that I had with me as a single parent. You know, and I knew where they was at, and that's all I can do. Is know where they was at. You know, so I was pretty messed up. The book talks about that being sufficiently mangled. You know, we was talking about, I was talking to a guy a little while ago, you know, he was talking about, that last one. He's like, that last one was rough. I said, I needed that one. That's the one I needed, right? That rough one. You know, because it ain't all them ones I, you know, breaking bottles, swearing off, you know, I'm going to go hit another altar call, you know what I'm saying, and I'm going to do all this stuff. And it ain't those. I don't count those a lot. It's just as experiences, but it's that last one. You know what I'm saying? And I didn't know it was my last one, but it was my last one. You know, I was born and raised in Hartford, Connecticut, and the big book says I'm supposed to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, I was born and raised in Hartford, man. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I had a great childhood. I mean, I had no complaints. You know, I can remember two addresses, 132 Enfield Street and 112 Love Lane. You know what I mean? And I remember I was about 8, 9 years old when I moved on Love Lane. And the house was like, you know, it's got trees and half my house was house, half my street was houses. The other half was a park. I lived right next to the park. We had a baseball diamond. We had a basketball court. And we had a big old field where we used to play sandlot football in. You know what I mean? And that's back in the days when you would challenge other neighborhoods and they'd come to your neighborhood and you try to kick the crap out of them. You know what I mean? You know, and, guys broke arms and everything, because that's how we play sandlot football. We have zero equipment, you know what I'm saying? But we playing tackle, you know. And we had this one game called cremation, which was the most nuttiest game on the planet. It's like, whoever get the ball, jump them, you know what I mean? And we used to love to play cremation, man. You know, everybody go home, knot it up and all that kind of stuff. But kids are different today. They can't play games like that. You know, they need helmets and elbow pads and all other kind of stuff. But that's another story. You know what I'm saying? That's another story. But, so all intents and purposes, I had a great childhood. And I believe that there was a couple of things in my childhood that actually determined the type of man that I am today and would help me stay in that disease a lot longer than necessary, but that's not true. I stayed there as long as I needed to in order to get to where I am today, right? So if I'm a sum total of all my experiences, I can't complain about none of it. But one of the things that I did was when I moved to this neighborhood called Love Lane is I was, you know, mom and pop moved there first, and I remember coming out, I'm like 9 years old, and I see these twins across the street, young guys my age. I started talking to them, everything was good, and I remember seeing this little young lady, and by this time my hormones was kicking in, so I made a comment on her anatomy. She didn't really appreciate it, you know. And she said she's going to tell her cousin to kick my ass. I said, get your cousin, you know. And she did. And, and when he showed up, you know, this was like a fear I've never felt before. And when I first seen him, you know, he ran up on me. He was supposed to be our age, but he had muscles everywhere, you know, And he was I never seen one before. I didn't even know what to call him at the time, but he's an albino black dude, right? And I'm like, you know, so I'm staring at amazement. He really didn't like me staring at him. And, you know, he's, you know, and he had freckles and he had red hair. And that's what he used to call him, red. And he's like, well, come back for him, throw him an F you up. And I'd be like, oh, man, you know, I just got here, you know. And my father was on the porch, you know what I'm saying? He picked up on his action, so he called me back in the house. He said, come back in the house, son. And he gave me this pep talk, right? He said, son, that kind of boy gonna keep coming back unless you do something to him. What I want you to do is get your baseball bat and your glove and your ball. Now, if he come back, drop the ball and the glove and you wham out with that baseball bat. So I looked at my father. I said, you think I can do it, Dad? He said, you can do it. Okay. You know, I got my stuff. I went back outside. Sure enough, here come Red. You know, back up the street. He took his groceries upstairs to his auntie, man. He came back, and I swear it looked like steam was coming out this dude's nose. You know what I mean? He ran right up on me. I did exactly what my father said. I dropped that ball, I dropped that glove, and I ran back with that bat, and I went, well, boom! Hit him one time. He took the bat and commenced to whooping my behind. And so, and while I'm on the ground taking an ass whooping like I never took before, and I'm saying, and these punches is coming real fast, I can hear his voice in the background. It was like, oh no, not my baby. It was my mama. So I knew Red was in trouble then, you know what I'm saying? And I could see my mama coming from across the street. Look, she's coming like, come on, mom, come on. You know what I mean? But when she got there, my father had ran out and grabbed her and he pulled her back. And he looked at me and said, you better work it out. And he brought my back on the porch. And I said, ah, this is some BS right here, man. You know what I mean? And I didn't work it out. What I did is I laid there and got my butt whooped till Red got tired. You know what I'm saying? And when he got tired, he got up, and I remember sniffling, and I was going to the house, and he patted me on the back. He said, yeah, you took that pretty good, kid, you know, and I got to the house, and I'm looking at my father, and I'm saying, it didn't go too well, Dan, and my father looked at me, he said, no, son, but you hung in there. You always hang in there, no matter how bad it looked, and I kind of took that into alcoholism, because no matter how bad it looked, I hung in there, and I was getting my behind work. Every weekend, every paycheck, every altar call, you know. And I was like, there's got to be a way out of this. You know, Red can't still be whooping on me like this. There's got to be a way out of this. Red got to get tired. But Red wasn't getting tired, which is not my acronym for alcoholism. You know what I mean? And so I would carry that into alcoholism. And then another situation where I thought kind of made me who I am was giving my what little bit of living skills I had was you know, we had the house where everybody came on Friday nights. You know, they played Pacino and Tonk, and everybody knew it. My father was the neighborhood numbers guy, and, you know, my earth thing, she worked for Pratt & Whitney, built airline engines, so she just knew a lot of people. And that's what our house was, you know. And I thought my mom was the hostess with the most. And I used to think my mom used to drink, but my mom never did drink, right? So apparently the first time my mother took a drink, the drink took her. And at 12 years old, Mom started doing strange stuff, you know, disappearing for days and leaving with Pop's car. And her and Dad got divorced and remarried twice off of Mom's alcoholism. And the last time he had left, I remember, which I also believe is another reason I stayed out there as long as I did, too, because I didn't actually identify as an alcoholic. I thought I was one of those others. You know, I was an alcoholic and a. But see, my mom would come home and she'd lay there, you know, in her urine and in her feces, and you know, and I would look at her, and I didn't know at that time what I was really feeling. You know what I'm saying? I really didn't know what I was feeling. I just didn't know what to do, you know. And I would go in her purse, because, you know, groceries wasn't being bought and all that kind of stuff. So I had to grow up a little faster than I needed to, you know. And I remember her starting to date this guy named Clarence, and he's a boyfriend. He tried to befriend me, and I wasn't having it. I was angry by this time, and I already told myself, I'm looking at it sometimes like, no matter what happens to me, I never get like that. I never do my kids like that. That's what I said, you know. And a friend of mine came knocking on the door one day, Marcus, and he said, hey, Jared, I just seen your mom down the street, man. She's on the corner. She's bumming coins. You need to go get her. And I remember in that particular moment how embarrassed I felt, how ashamed I felt, you know. And I knew I loved my mom, and I wanted to go help her, but I didn't know what to do with the emotion, right? So I told him, don't ever come back to my door with that again. And I closed the door in his face, right? So isolation, right, would be my new living skill, you know. And then, I mean, you know, mom got sober in 1977, never looked back. She died sober in 2008. I don't think she ever went to a meeting. Don't know she ever owned a big book. You know, the only story my mom ever told me was she came out of this place called Serenity Hill one morning, and she said she looked at a tree that only God could make. And she looked up at this tree, and she said, God, either fix me or allow me to die, because I don't want to do my kids like this no more. And from that day to this, till she passed, she didn't have a drink. But by the time mom got sober, I was already into what I was into. You know, I was 14 years old. I was shooting heroin. I was throwing after-hour parties. And, you know, she came back home sober, but okay, what? You know, I was doing what I was doing. And I never disrespected my mom directly, but I did what I wanted to do. You know, and by the time I was 18 years old, y'all, you know, I was life was looking kind of bleak. You know, I mean, I was going nowhere fast. You know, I was going nowhere fast. And I'm out there with my friend JC, and I'm apologize to the staunch AA people, but you know, like I said, I smoked a lot of crack, and I smoked some non-commercial weed too. And I remember it's about 2 a.m, and you know, back then you got to be kind of like a weed mechanic, right? Because that's when it came with the stem and the seeds, and it would burn up the polyester shirts. So, you know, you can't be walking around with holes in your shirt, so you have to actually do, you know, get your favorite album cover, you know, you break down the stem, and you rake it and let the seeds roll down, rake it, let the seeds roll down, and we rolled up that last one, man, and we smoked it, went in the house, and that was an infomercial. Be all that you can be in the army. I looked at my friend JC, he looked at me, I'm like, yeah. On Monday, we called some recruiters, and I started my mission on getting into the military. But like I said, I started doing what the hell I wanted to do. So by this time, I had amassed a little bit of a criminal record, right? A little bit of a criminal record, right? But at this time, you know, the military was the type of organization that you give them to us, Jan, and we'll make a man out of them. You know what I mean? And they did. They got a whole bunch of stuff, for a race, a sponge, whatever they had to do, but they allowed me to go into the military. But I had to sign promissory notes, like I'd get my GED, and I'd do this, and I'd do that. Fine, okay, just let me in. I wanted to get off the streets. And for 7 years, my life would get great, right? Although drinking did take on a different level, right? And now my sponsor always told me, look at my relationship with alcohol. Did it do more for me, or did it do more to me, Jerry? You know what I'm saying? And I always had to ask myself that question, because I never thought I had a real problem with alcohol. I only got like 2 DUIs in the military. But that was cool because, you know, they really wasn't tripping with it, right? They were just like, Jerry, be good for 3 months. Okay, Sarge. And I'd be good for 3 months and they'd go away, you know. And like I said, life would get good for like 7 years, man. I'm married. I got a wife. I got 2 kids. And I got one by another lady back home, Jamie. And I just got back from Germany. You know, and I'm living in Newport News, Virginia, and I, you know, I mean, life couldn't get no better. I had just took my sergeant exam. I'm waiting on my stripes, and we had some of the families visiting at this particular time. And 7 years removed from shooting heroin, 7 years removed, right? And they were down there doing lines and all that kind of stuff. I excused myself. I went to bed, and I went to I went upstairs, and I went to use the bathroom, and I found a syringe in my trash can. So I knew Lamar, my brother-in-law, had just came out of my bathroom. So I figured I'm going to have a talk with Lamar. I'm not going to embarrass him in front of the women folk. I'm going to take him outside and talk to him like man to man, right? And I told him outside, and I said, like, look, Lamar, I don't care what you do, man, or how you get down, man, but you know you can't be bringing that stuff up in my house like this. You know what I'm saying? You got to give me a little more respect. I'm a soldier. I can't be, you know, you messing up my career here. You know, he's like, oh, I'm sorry, man. I said, but he said, what you mean? I said, well, you can't be getting high like that up in here, man. You know what I'm saying? He's like, oh, no, 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 I'm a diabetic. And I'm like, oh, I ain't never seen nobody use them for the right stuff before. You know, I've never, you know, I just assumed everybody was getting high with them. You know what I mean? And so that was an eye opener, you know. And so he went back to the party. I went up to go to the bed. I went to go to bed, and all of a sudden my head started doing something crazy. You know, it said, wait a minute. They doing lines. He has syringes. Huh. Nah, you ain't never did just cocaine before. You know, you know, let's give it a shot. So I'm sitting there having this conversation with myself. So I go talk him out of some, and I talk them out of some, and before you know it, I went back upstairs to the bathroom, and 7 years removed from putting anything in my veins, I came back downstairs like the Tasmanian devil. And everybody had but one question, who are you? Because I was talking fast and I was fleecing my family. And it only took 9 months after that to put that 7-year military career right up my veins. And I'm standing there in front of the CEO, right, about to get my last Article 15. Now, mind you, I just told you I just took my E5 exam, and I'm about to be a buck sergeant. And I'm standing in front of my CEO, less ranked than when I went in the military, right? Because now I'm below the mosquito wings, right? And I'm standing there at parade rest, and he asks me a question. He's asking me questions, and he's like, well, Private Millen, if you just tell me what's wrong, we can help you. And I think looking back on it now, he wanted me to tell him that I had a drug problem, and they might even put me in a program. But you know where I come from, hip, slick, and cool. If you still asking questions, you ain't got the answers. And I ain't about to snitch on myself. You know what I'm saying? You got the wrong guy. But the truth of the matter was, that was the hip, slick, and cool talking. But you know, in my heart of hearts, deep down where don't nobody else live, when he asked me what was really going on with me, I didn't know. Because by this time, my mother had came and got the kids. I had turned my on-base housing into the dope spot. You know what I'm saying? I'm on house arrest. Been on house arrest for like the last 5 months. You know, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I didn't know. And I got out the military. They gave me an honorable discharge under general conditions, y'all. And that was a blessing in disguise, you know. And I'm down in Virginia, and I ain't even got bus fare to get home. And my baby sister sent me a bus ticket. Now, mind you, I don't think stuff's still that bad yet. You know what I'm saying? It's not that bad. You know what I mean? I can get a job, you know. And she sent me a bus ticket, sent me back home to Connecticut, and I got back home to Hartford, Connecticut. And by this time, I had been gone. It had been close to 8 years, and my baby sister was the largest drug dealer on the north end of Hartford. And she offered me a job. And I decided to take a job with my baby sister. And that didn't work out too well. That lasted about 6 months. About the time that 6 months was up, there was a contract put on my life by my baby sister and her girlfriend. And they pretty much ran me out of town. And that's how I ended up in California. And some of the people that I grew up with was already out here. They heard about what was happening. And they thought it was a good idea if I left town. And the only reason I left town because I felt like I was putting my mother's life in danger as well. So it was time to leave, you know. And I came to California, you know, in 1990. And I figured it'd be a great start, you know. Do something different. Do something new with my life, you know. And I got to California, and I don't know, man, maybe I should have stopped by the Welcome Center or something before I got here. To see what the rules is on, you know, neighborhood, gangs, colors, what black dudes can wear, what black dudes can't wear. I don't know. But by the time I got out here, my ex-wife and her sister were actually smoking, and they would send me out to look for work every day. And that's what I would do. I'd get up, you know, and I'd go look for work, and that was the condition of me staying there to make sure I'd be self-supporting and all that kind of stuff. And this one particular day, they asked me to go get some for them. I didn't have to go to work, and they was going to give me $40 in cash. They sent me down to a place called the Common Leaders in Long Beach, California. And I had only had a few outfits left. What I would consider my best East Coast outfit was some red and black Pumas with no shoestrings in them and some red leather pants and a red and white and black Run DMC shirt with a red leather cap tilt to the left, man. And yeah, right. She's kind of starting to get the picture, right? So I slide up into these projects, right, that belong to the Crips, right? I don't know no better. And I'm talking East Coast. Like, yo, what's up, young bloods? I see these four dudes on some swings. And what's up, young bloods? You know, because that's what we call people younger than us. It's a term of endearment for where I'm from. But out here, I guess it means something else. And You know, them four youngsters jumped on me so fast and they beat me up so fast, y'all. I ain't never took a butt whooping that fast before in my life. My best thinking that night after this guy named Big Mike got them guys off me, I went back home. I was all knotted up. I didn't have no more clothes on. Was to actually, this is an open meeting, right? Okay. Was to actually take a hit off this thing called the pipe. And my life would change forever. It took about 3 months. I was put out the house with the ex-wife and the sister with the kids. And for 9 years, I would take these kids on a ride that would just change my life forever. And that stuff would have me do stuff when I was wide awake. And I would watch myself screwing over the ones I would love the most. And I just couldn't understand why. You know, I just couldn't understand why. I mean, I thought it was bad then, but it got real, real bad now, right? And I, you know, like I said, and I would just, I couldn't understand what was wrong with me. And I mean, and the book talks about no matter how great the necessity of the wish, what makes me an alcoholic is once I put one in my body, I can't stop. And I didn't know that then. I thought there was a way I could figure it out. You know, Red can't still be winning. You know, so, you know, it got to the point where this thing got so bad, I wasn't buying Christmas toys at Christmas. I wasn't buying birthday gifts at birthdays. And the kids were kind of dying the same alcoholic death that I was at that particular time, you know. And I remember this particular Christmas. It was about 3 days before Christmas. I was living in Bellflower. And the auntie showed up, right? Because they're tired of hearing me cry about not being able to provide for my own children. And they had brought toys for my kids, right? And they made me do like a Scout's Honor promise before they gave me the toys. And they asked me, they said, Jerry, what would it take for you not to sell these toys? Because they already, by this time, everybody knew who I was. You know, I said, well, let me see. How about some Seagram 7 and a pack of Newports? And they say, that's it. I say, that's it. They went to the liquor store right next door. They gave me a half a gallon of Seagram 7. A liter of 7-Up, and they gave me 3 packs of Newports. Let me paint the picture of my luxurious apartment in Bellflower. There was a Christmas tree that, you know, the kind you stick the arms in. I couldn't find half the arms, but that didn't matter. The kids just wanted something up. And they had some little scraggly lights around them, and I was able to put, like, a towel around the bottom. I didn't even know what that thing was. You call it a runner or something. But, you know, I had a brown towel around the bottom. There wasn't no water in it because it was a fake tree. In my living room TV was a 12-inch black and white. And y'all know the only reason I had that 12-inch black and white is because wouldn't nobody take it, right? And Top Ramen was the meal of the day in the cabinet, you know. And I'd sit there, and I was sitting there drinking that Seagram 7 as long as I could drink that Seagram 7. But by 2:30 in the morning, that Seagram 7 wasn't doing what that Seagram 7 needed to do. It was time for a little snap, crackle, and pop. So I loaded up them toys after I opened them up and see what they were. One was an electric racetrack, one was a train track, and there was some couple other things in there. I put them in the trunk. And as I'm loading up the trunk, my 5-year-old wakes up, right? And the ex was at the house at the time, and she said, take him with you. No problem. I load up the trunk. I put him in the car with me, and I drive down to Compton, to Greenleaf and Long Beach Boulevard. And I pull up in the alley where I usually go, right? Kind of foggy. There's a couple of homies in the alley. I'm like, cool. I ain't got to get out the car and leave him in the car by himself. So I pull to a stop, and as they walk up to the car, you know, they're going in their pockets, but they ain't going in for the rock. They're going in for the lead. And both of them whip out pistols, and they start shooting off the car. And so I push my son to the floor, and I'm checking myself for holes as I'm trying to get out this alley. And I'm starting to panic because he's not moving and I'm not hit. So I figured if I'm not hit, he must be hit. And he's not talking. And so as soon as I get out the alley, I'm looking for the police. I can't find any police. So I drive all the way back to the Bellflower with that child on the floor of that car. And when I got home and I pulled that car in, his mama came running out and she was holding the chest. And she had to ask me what happened, like she had felt something. And the longest walk I took was around that car because I didn't want to see where alcoholism had brought me. And when I picked that boy up, he wasn't dead and he wasn't hit, but he was in shock. I love to tell you that December the 23rd of 1995, in that situation was enough for me to stop drinking and using. But it wasn't. I held that child tight. I held him very close to my chest. And I cried and I blew snot in that parking lot. And I just knew that was going to be enough for me to stop killing myself and putting their lives in danger. Well, you know, my sobriety date, if you remember, December the 2nd of 1999. So that wasn't enough. And there would be more to come. Right? Tried to trade my 12-year-old daughter for one more. If you just give me one more. You know, sometimes I look at her and I cry. You know, because I almost changed her life forever. So, the kind of God that I'm giving praise and thanks to tonight is the kind of God that no matter how far down the scale this alcoholic went, he see how my experience could benefit others. Amazing. And I wasn't finished. There would be four more years. And my last run was in Las Vegas, Nevada. My son and them had went 13-0 that year, and they was invited up to a Pop Warner football tournament. It was Thanksgiving weekend. And I do what an alcoholic like me do once I take a drink. See, I couldn't associate the drinking with the drugs. I just couldn't associate it. I couldn't put that two together. It just didn't make common math to me, you know. And I did what I do, you know. And I'm laying there in the bed next to my friend and his son in the bed with him and my son in the bed with me, man. And for all, you know, it's going to be a great weekend if I just don't take a drink. And I take a drink. And I can't sleep. And I wait till he starts snoring. And I take his keys. His wife's car. I sell everything that man had in that car. I was out all night. And I spent all the kids' money they had for lunch. And when I came back the next morning, this ought to be kind of hilarious. I snuck back into the hotel to see if there was anything left in the room. And there was a drink on the table right outside the elevator with a cigarette butt in it. And I was thirsty. I pulled that cigarette butt out and I took that drink. And when the door to the elevator opened, there was a lady, because I had been introduced to the program by this time, who I knew from Altadena named Millie Lee, and three other people standing in the elevator with AA Roundup badges. And she just looked at me and shook my head. And I felt that big. But I was still going to that room. And when I got to that room, my friend was there. And, you know, I told him about falling off the wagon. And he's like, what's that? You know, I said, well, I started drinking. He said, I know. I stole your car. I did this. I did that. He was angry. He was upset. And next thing I know, well, none of the parents want to mess with me no more. And so I'm sitting on the bus with the kids. 12-year-olds. They have no filter. They was like, why is Jerry Dad on the bus with us? One kid said, he smelled funny. You know. Another kid said, ain't them the clothes he had on yesterday? You know. And then I look at my son, and he just got his head down. Because once again, I done embarrassed him. Now, mind you, I was stuck in Las Vegas because I couldn't ride home with nobody. You know, couldn't ride. Nobody wanted to mess with me. It was my ex-wife and her husband that drove all the way up from Palmdale to Las Vegas to come pick me up. And that was one of the longest rides I took, y'all. And I'm riding all the way back to Covina, California, man. And, man, nobody said nothing to nobody. And the last thing her husband said to me when he let me out the car was, Jerry, be good to yourself, man, if you can, you know. And by this time, I had been around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to say that in all fairness, because my sponsor also taught me that being in AA and being around AA is two different places. You know what I mean? Because I had a lot of 12-step commitments. As a matter of fact, my last run, I had three literature commitments. And I had them all in the trunk of this car that ended up in Pick Apart. Because when I got back home, my last check was in the mailbox. And I did what I did with that check, and then that car ended up at Pick Apart that Sunday morning with three literature commitments in the trunk. And I remember the guy running trying to catch me. He says, hey, there's a bunch of books in the trunk of your car. Do you want them? I'm like, not going to need them. Not going to need them. you know. And that night, sitting on the edge of that bed, man, in that studio apartment, man, and I just started feeling real bad and real sad for myself. And I remember asking the question, God, why? Why me? Why me? And the voice came back real clear. It says, why not you? I done gave you everything you need to combat this disease, and you chose not to use none of it, you know. And I didn't know what that meant. And then my sponsor explained it to me. He says, well, you got all the 12-step commitments, Jerry. You got a couple of 12-step girlfriends, you know what I mean? And you go to a lot of 12-step meetings, son, and I haven't seen you miss a 12-step barbecue, you know. He said, but you haven't done the 12 steps. So he said the price it takes to get here is different than the price it is to stay. You know, so that's why I push the 12 steps now on anybody that I work with, because I know it introduced me to a God, because they told me that lack of power was my limit. It introduced me to a power by which I can live by, the kind of power that no matter how great the necessity to which, I don't have to take one. You know, and once I got introduced to that power, because I called my sponsor that morning and I told him what was going on. And I was like, I know you're going to talk bad about me, but I just need to come clean. And I told him exactly what was going on with me. And he says, Jerry, I'm glad you called. I said, what? He said, I've missed you. He said, you can come back to the rooms and don't even have to identify as a newcomer. I just want you to come back. And that's not what my head told me he was going to tell me. You know, he just said, but I just need you to answer one question. And I said, what's that, Earl? He said, what are you willing to do different this time? And I said, I don't know. Whatever you tell me. He said, good. Stay right where you at. I'm going to call you back. So he called this guy named Carl Morris at a pointing house in Covina, California. And they got me in on the intake that day. And he says, you say you sure you're willing to do anything? I said, I'm willing to do anything, not to stop living like I'm living right now. And I'm telling you, from that decision to this day, you know, God has just been showing up in my life in all kind of mighty ways. But I had to see these little surrenders, right? Because, see, I didn't realize that I had to surrender to win. Because, see, I fought red at 9 years old. Man, we don't surrender. You don't give up. But this is the only place you go where, you know, no mas, man, I'm beat up. You throw the paws up. You got to surrender to win. I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that you had to throw them up, you know. And so I did an intake with this guy named Kyle Morris, and he asked me what my drug of choice was, and I told him. And he said something pretty funny. He said, well, you don't have any money to move in, do you? I said, no, I don't. Thank you for understanding, you know. And he said, but since you're Earl, baby, I'm going to have you moving anyway. And I moved into that house, 304 Roland Avenue in West Covina, California. And I didn't understand what cleaning walls had to do with staying sober, or mowing the grass at this sober living had to do with staying sober, or cleaning toilets, you know, had to do with staying sober, or helping somebody else move into their new apartment had to do with staying sober. But what I did promise myself was I wasn't going to leave that place until I actually did those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I needed to find this power that you guys were talking about that I needed to live by. You know, I was having what they call a Karate Kid experience. Now, when I got to the sober living, I don't know if you guys can remember, but there was this show on TV called In Living Color. Okay, Jim Carrey had a character called Fire Marshal Bill. That's who answered the door. Now, mind you, I was having mixed emotions at this moment, because this dude was short and his name was Don, and he was talking and his lips was going at one speed and his teeth was going at a different speed, right? And I swear, I just thought I took one drink too many, right? And he was like, hey, Jimmy, how you doing? And I'm like, this is bad, you know. And he asked, he said, are you hungry? And I said, yeah, and I started crying on the doorstep of that sober living. Broke me down, man. Fire Marshal Bill broke me down on the doorstep of that sober living, man. And I knew that was another surrender, you know. And I went into that sober living, man, and all kind of amazing things started to happen. And I actually started working those steps. And thank God that my sponsor actually listened to me, you know, because when I got to that fourth step and I got to the amends list, you know, he told me, you know, you started making a list of people. He looked at the amends list. He said, no, there's some people missing, because I told you my sister had put a contract on my life and I didn't really want to have anything to do with her. So he says, it doesn't matter. I need to put her on the list. You know what I'm saying? So she was in the never column now. And I meant never. All right. I meant never. Hate was good. It fueled, you know, it kept me moving. You know what I'm saying? It was the gas I needed. And it took me a year to save up enough money to make amends to my mom. My first amends, right, to my mom. You know, she hadn't seen me in 11 years. And I got off the plane about 10 o'clock at Bradley International, And I got a little rented car, and I went to my mom's house, and I knocked on the door. It was about 10:30 at night. My mom's short like me. She's shorter than me, you know. And when she opened the door at this, it's an independent living, just short of an assisted living, you know what I mean? And she seen my face, and she seen me, man, and she grabbed my face, and she started crying. And she stood there, and she cried, and she cried. And when she was able to get out some words, what she said was, her prayer for the last 11 years is that she see her baby boy one more time before she passed. And there I stood, you know, and there I stood. And she hugged me, and I was like, Ma, I got to go bathroom, you know. Can I get a house? And I got up in that house, man, and I'm trying to make this amends to this woman. She won't sit still. I'm trying to like, Ma, I got a script. I'm telling her, look, I got to do this in order for me to stay sober. Ma, you want me to stay sober? And she's like, yeah, yeah. And she's making salmon croquettes. She's scrambling up brown eggs. And she's and I'm getting me a pot of grits, man. And I ain't smelled food like that in a long time. In a long time. And I asked, and I laid it out for her, and I gave her my amends, you know, and I asked her, has there anything I missed? You know, because I thought I did all the damage out here on the West Coast. I didn't know how much damage I did back there, you know, and thank God for good sponsorship, you know. He told me about stealing, you know, and kind of stuff. You know, he said the greatest crime one can commit against oneself is to steal from yourself and not even know what's missing. So what I stole from her was peace, serenity, and all that other good stuff when she would call when she couldn't find me, when months on end she didn't hear from me. All that kind of stuff I stole from my mama. But she brought something else to my attention. She said, well, you remember that stuff you used to do when you was like 14? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, boy, I used to stand over you because you used to be so still. I didn't know if you was dead or alive. I would be late for work sometimes just to try to get a movement out of you. And I was like, phew. So I had to apologize for that. And then I hit it with the question. What can I do to make it right, to make you whole as I possibly can? I'm willing to do anything over the combat and victory over King Alcohol. And she looked around. She was smoking that long behind more cigarette. And she looked around. She ain't think too long. She said, if you make it right with your baby sister, that'll make me whole. I said, oh, damn it. Anything but that, you know. But she prefaced it by saying, you know, baby, when I die, all you're going to have is your baby sister. That's how she prefaced it. Then she hit me with it. And she said, you said anything? And I said, yeah, I said anything. And she said, okay, I can call her right now. It's about 2 a.m. I can call her right now. She called my baby sister. Now, mind you, I've been hating her for all these years. She's the enemy, period, point blank, in a sentence. You know, every time something bad happened to me, I blamed her because she ran me out of, you know, she ran me off the block. You know what I'm saying? I blamed her. And I had this hate, man, that was just there, and I didn't know what to do with it. And she called my baby sister. When my baby sister showed up, you know, she knocked on the door, man, and it was like that, dun, 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 dun. I'm like, oh. I answered the door. Something happened. From the time I had my hands on that doorknob to when I opened it. When I looked at this, my baby sister, she wasn't that villain anymore. She was that baby sister that had I been in position, she might have not been doing what she was actually doing. When I looked at my baby sister, she looked very vulnerable. When I looked at my baby sister, I didn't know that because of what she had done to me, she had tried to kill herself. See, when I look at my baby sister, see, the ripple effect of alcoholism just runs deep. It just runs deep. And I didn't know none of that about my sister, but I would find out that night. And all the hate left. And I couldn't have removed it. And then I really believed that there was a God in my life doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. And we hugged and we cried and we hugged and we cried. And it was a long night at my mama's house that night, you know. So I never say never when it comes to this program. And I tell my sponsees to do the same thing, you know. So if you be new, than myself. You know, my prayer for you is the gift of desperation, man, and that this thing actually works. And that my bottom, your bottom, might not look like my bottom, but it doesn't matter. See, we relate to the similarities, you know. You know how you feel when you spend that paycheck? You know, it started off fun on Friday, now here it is Sunday, and they getting ready to throw your ass out that room, and, you know, lighting up stucco and all that other kind of stuff. To try to get one more, you know. And then, you know, once I made that amends, though, to my baby sister, my mom, man, my life would get a whole lot. You know, it became a little easier. But there was one more hurdle that I had to face. You know, I told you that there was a son, my oldest son, you know, that he was 12 when I dropped him off. That was the last time I seen him. He would be 28 before we got reacquainted. Now, mind you, he didn't have to allow me in his life whatsoever. And he was kind of hard to find. And my daughter, my oldest daughter, found him. And she called me. She said, "Dad, I found Jamie." And I said, "What?" I'm 9 years sober. I said, "What are you doing? You got 4 kids. Ain't you busy enough?" You know? She's like, "Yeah, I found Jamie." And I'm like, "Okay." She says, "I'm going to hook you up on the three-way." No, click, you know, freaking daughter of mine, man. So she's trying to hook up the call. And actually, I was able to listen, but they couldn't hear me. And she's telling him of what a great guy I am. I've been sober 9 years and that I'm doing all this kind of stuff. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm in a program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he should really give me a chance because I'm this real great guy. And Jamie was pretty blunt with it. He said, "You know, it's really good to hear from you, Mies." He says, "That might be who Dad is to y'all, but that's not who he is to me." And I was like, "Oh, okay." That was a gut shot. And I prayed about it, and I prayed about it. And, you know, she gave my daughter his number, and I called him. And he allowed me to come see him. Right? And this was Thanksgiving. So I fly back into New York. You know, he granted me the audience. And I'm pulling around the corner. I'm in Brooklyn. I'm nervous as heck because I don't think this is going to go that well. But I got to do this to stay sober. You know what I'm saying? And I called him on the cell, and I'm like, I'm on your block. I'm coming on your block. And he says, "Okay, pull over and park. I'm coming right out," right? And I hit a trash can and everything, and I look in the rearview mirror, right? Here come this kid, right? I ain't seen in 16 years. And he ran up to the car, and he stood at my window with a smile on his face. And I just got out the car and hugged him. He said he had been practicing hating me for all these years. He said, "But something happened when he heard my voice." So he allowed me that visitation. And I get up in there, and I'm going through my spiel with the amends. And then all of a sudden, I throw God out of the driver's seat, and I put Jerry in the driver's seat, right? Because it's going too good, right? So I got to throw some speed bumps on it. So I tell him, I said, you really be glad you wasn't there, man. Because, man, I put your sister and your baby brother through hell." And he was like, "At least I would have had somebody to go through it with." You know, that kid's in Dubai right now. He's a published author. So I'll give you the full circle. Right now, he's a published author. He's working on his second novel. He just got finished, called Wings of Red. I'm in both of his novels, and the first one, not too pretty of a picture, obviously, because it's about his 11th grade year in college when all the scholarships had ran out, all the funds had ran out, and the dean was going to have to put him out of school. And the dean said, "Well, look, can you just please find a parent of yours?" His mother was locked up in a jail in Columbia, and he hadn't seen me, so he didn't know where I was at. And he said, "I know not where none of my parents are." And he lived sleeping on subways and all that kind of stuff. But he's doing real good now. You know what I'm saying? God looked out for him just like he looked out for us, man. And we got like a real good relationship right now. A very good relationship right now. You know, so, you know, I would just say this, never say never when it comes to the program Alcoholics Anonymous, man. Because, you know, you never know what God can do. You know, my motto is I do the footwork and he handle the results. You know, and I leave it up to God, the results. I try to stay out of the result business because I don't know what's good for me sometimes. I really don't, you know. I know right now if I made the money when I first got sober that I make right now, I wouldn't be standing here tonight. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just grateful for my life today. You know, they talk about this, just one story I heard that kind of hit home with me, man. It talks about this guy walking through life and he's making all kind of bad decisions, you know, and he ends up down in this really, really dark hole, and it's dark down there, you know, and there's a preacher that comes by and he says, "I can't get down there, but I'll write this prayer on a piece of paper," and he threw it down to him, you know. And the cop said, the cop came by. He says, well, I think I can give you a ticket, but I'm going to let you slide this time, you know. And a good Samaritan came by and said, yeah, it's a little bit too deep for me down there, too. But then somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous came by, and they jumped down the hole with him. And the guy in the hole said, well, that's great. Now we both down here. But the guy from Alcoholics Anonymous said, yeah, I know, but I've been here before, and I know the way out, you know. So Alcoholics Anonymous about me, for me, means that when somebody reaches out for help, the hand for Alcoholics Anonymous, we should be there to help, you know, and I truly believe that, you know. So that's why I don't know what keeps me sober, whether it's the service, whether it's working with others, whether it's the steps. I know the steps is powerful because I'm tapped into a power greater than myself. You know, it's kind of helped recreate my life, man. So I just keep doing it all. And since I'm about to start rambling, I'm going to shut it down for them. My name is Jared. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for letting me share.
Let's keep it going for Jerry and also for Kendall. Thank you guys very much.